Our new Letters on the Air classic series takes us back to the writing well to draw inspiration from fiction writers who all share how family and place impact their work. Here's MacArthur genius George Saunders.
To me, the humor in a story, one, it comes from my childhood. I grew up in Chicago, and in our neighborhood, everything that was sincere and heartfelt was always expressed sort of sideways, you know. If you had an uncle who really admired you, he'd say, you jag off. You know, and he'd pretend to knee you in the groin or something. And when you're in that system of meaning, I knew that he meant, I love you. You know, I have, so whenever somebody would get really emotional, it was almost like it was so strong that they couldn't say it directly. They had to sort of couch it in something else. So it was kind of an encoded language.
George Saunders, along with the famous South Carolina writer, the late Pat Conroy, and Brooklyn's Elizabeth Gaffney, the editor-at-large of an independent magazine of literature and culture called A Public Space. They all share stories about their own writing and give some advice for would-be writers on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Pat Conroy authored a dozen books, mostly novels, with several made into movies, including The Great Santini. He also wrote a Deep South cookbook and a couple of memoirs, including his 2013 The Death of Santini, that he hoped would put to rest the story of his father. While on tour for this book, he stopped at Kansas City's Unity Temple to visit with Rainy Day Bookstore owner Vivian Jennings in front of an audience of his readers. Here's a portion of their conversation.
You describe in The Great Santini a father who did not know how to love, a father who did not know how to try. Talk to us about the family reaction to the book's release.
Dad's family in Chicago, Chicago Irish, went nuts. My grandmother called me up and called me Judas Iscariot. She said she'd never speak to me again. She never did. And then my mother's family even jumped on me. I was young. That's the only thing I do in defense of myself. Now, if I write in the book, I'd make it an Inuit family living in the Aleutian Islands. You know, and my father would be a whale hunter, and we would. The family would make igloos each winter. But I call it The Great Santini, and that was my father's nickname in the Marine Corps. I made him a Marine.
Yeah.
Why didn't I make him Air Force? I made him a pilot. Why didn't I make him a grunt, an infantryman? A million things I wonder now. But I sort of told it, you know, the way I lived it and used the people I knew, my mother, my father, my sister, my brothers, and used those people. And I wanted to tell the truth about the way I grew up. I wanted to say, here is how I was raised, my mother was treated, and everybody in my family was raised by this man. And I hated Dad from the time I was in diapers until the time that book came out. And it was only the book coming out that salvaged anything between me and Dad at all. And what I knew is Dad was much worse than I had written. But in 1976, when that book came out, people were not ready to hear about abuse because I had an 80-year-old editor in Boston, and she would say, no human being would treat their child like this. And I said, you want to bet? And it was that kind of reaction I got that made this book necessary.
But your father hated it.
Yes.
But then he changed his mind a little bit when the movie came along, didn't he?
Dad thought, to my amazement, he was a great father, a great husband, a great provider, that he had done what, you know, the men of his generation were supposed to do. You know, we all got educated. So Dad thought he'd done a great job. He loathed the book. But then Hollywood came calling.
Yeah.
And so the happiest I've ever seen my father, by far, was the day he burst into my apartment early in the morning. And he said, son, you and I were nominated for Academy Awards last night. And then he said, your mother didn't get squats. And so the movie, it did change, you know, everything. And Dad eventually relented and ended up, he would sign books beside me. Every book I wrote from the Great Santini forward, he would be sitting beside me.
You need to talk to us just a little bit about Buford.
Yes. From the day I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Atlanta Naval Air Station, until I was 15, moving into Buford, South Carolina, we had moved 23 different times. And Dad had the addresses. He'd say, "Hey, you want to know where you were conceived?" "No." And he would go through these things. "Yeah, I remember that place." And, "Yeah, I remember that place. We were only there for 6 months, and then we were there for 8 months." And he went through this thing, and it drove me crazy as a kid. And when I was heading for Buford, my third high school, I had had it, and I told my mother. And then she said something that stuck with me. She said, "I would make Buford, South Carolina, my home. We're going to be here 2 years. And because you've moved so much, and we've all been serving the military, serving the Marine Corps, we can pick any city in the country as our hometown. And nobody can argue with us about it." So I picked poor Buford. And it's gotten to be so much a part of the town's, I guess, lore. A travel book came out about 10 years ago in which neighbors remembered me riding my tricycle around the point. You know, if I had, I'd have been 18 years old riding that tricycle.
You know what? We're going to do a little sidebar about Cassandra. Tell about how you met, and then tell about the fact that she has a new book out.
Oh, that's right. I've got to push my wife's book, too. She reminded me of that tonight on the phone. I married a novelist from Pinkard, Alabama. And she was very smart about it. I never saw Pinkard until after we were married. And as we drove up to the peanut farm where she was raised, I said, "Sandra, no offense, but I would never have married you had I knew you grew up here." I simply could not believe it. You know, she's a novelist, she's a great novelist. And where she changed the writing of novels for me is I walk by her writing room, and this always amazes me. I walk by her writing room and I hear, "Ha, ha, 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 ha." And I once thought she had a psychotic break, you know. And so I said, "Are you okay, Sandra?" She says, "I just wrote something to crack myself up." And I said, "You laugh at what you write?" And that seems unbelievable to me. And, you know, you'll find me weeping at my desk. But she seems to have a love of writing and a joy of writing that is infectious. And it's made me like it better.
Tell a little bit about South Abroad, your love letter to the city that's full of gardens and mystery and magic, Charleston.
Ah, Charleston, yes. I felt so lucky as a young writer being in the city of Charleston. And I was under the influence of Thomas Wolfe, so I would walk the city like Wolfe used to walk Brooklyn. And God, I was pretentious. But anyway, I did it. And I would, you know, try to memorize everything and learn about every shape of window and architecture. And I told myself, someday I'm going to write about that city. Charleston had that level of romance and mystery, and they had all their houses turned away from you. So the gardens, you couldn't see them. They're in the backyard, or you have to look through gates. And I used to especially love walking around at night, because then I could see the people eating dinner. Husbands in coat and tie, and you know, just got home from the law office. And I thought, this is how American families do it. And I just learned a lot from being in that city, falling in love with that city. And I did not realize it, but already I'd fallen in love with landscape. I'd fallen in love with place. And a writer, one of the things I look for when I read a writer is always look if they have a sense of place. If they're from New York, give me New York. If they're from Kansas City, give it to me straight. I want to see it and hear it, feel it.
One last thing. I passed by your book, The Reading Life, because I wanted to do it at the end. Love the book. Books have been a very important part of your life, obviously. But tell them just a little bit about the bookstore and your book, The Reading Life.
When I moved to Atlanta from Beaufort, this was after The Water's Wide came out. For 20 years, I was considered what was known as a communist in South Carolina. So I couldn't, you know, I didn't feel comfortable living there. So we moved to Atlanta, and one of the first things, you know, I was attracted to is I passed a bookstore, and I realized I didn't own any hardbound books except the ones I had written. So I saw this little antiquarian bookstore, the old New York Bookshop, and I walked in, and it changed every single thing about my life. Because I looked on the bookshelves, I could buy any book the greatest writers had ever written. And if he didn't have it, he could find it for me. So for the next 30 years, and I now have, I think, 7,000 to 9,000 books, and I adore them. I love the way they look and smell. I would like to be buried under a pile of them. Just, you know. But it is something that has given me such solace, and I think I got another college education because I hung around that bookstore so long and so often. And I think almost every book that I wanted to read in the world came through there eventually, and I snagged it. And there are many things wrong with me, but I am a well-read man.
Pat Conroy, at Kansas City's Unity Temple with Rainy Day Bookstore's Vivian Jennings. He was on tour with his 2013 memoir, The Death of Santini, and the novel Moonrise by his wife, Cassandra King. There's a link to the whole conversation at newletters.org under Back to the Writing Well. Conroy's last book, A Low Country Heart, Reflections on a Writing Life, was published after his 2016 death. Next on New Letters on the Air, Elizabeth Gaffney brings to life her native New York in her novel, When the World Was Young. It looks at post-World War II Brooklyn through the eyes of Wally Baker, a young girl dealing with the loss of her mother, Stella. In 2015, Gaffney discussed the book and the literary magazine, A Public Space, at the Kansas City Public Library with UMKC novelist Whitney Terrell.
I know that the story of the suicide of Stella comes out of your family to a certain extent, right? I mean, that was sort of the original seed for the book. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're quite right. The whole story started for me with hearing a family anecdote being remembered by my mother and a cousin of hers over coffee one day when he came to visit. And it was something I heard in my 30s. So I was kind of shocked and disappointed not to have ever known about this grandmother.
Oh, wow, that happens all the time in this book, where people are like shocked and disappointed to not have been told something that they thought they should have been told a long time ago.
I think that's one of the main themes of the book is families keeping secrets,
right,
and people figuring out how to live their lives only once they uncover the truth.
Right.
What happened was a boarder came to stay with my great-grandparents during World War II. He was from somewhere like Kansas, or it could have been Missouri. Nobody really knows. Somewhere out there in the Midwest. And he became my great-grandmother's lover, which is part of the scandal of my family story that partly inspired the narrative of the book. And so that guy I have completely imagined, and his name is Mr. Niederman. And when the war ended, the gentleman went back to wherever he had come from, and my great-grandmother got rather depressed and laid down in front of a gas oven and turned it on and committed suicide. So there's a history of depression in my family that I never knew about, and I had suffered from depression as a young girl, and I was kind of angry that nobody let me know, or, you know, they didn't even think that psychotherapy or anything like that was appropriate because it was kind of embarrassing, and why would you talk to strangers about your problems? Meanwhile, my great-grandmother solved her problems by killing herself. I felt that somebody should have gotten a heads up there that there was something better you could do. So I decided to write a novel about it in a way, but it's all very different. You know, it's not really about my family. It's sort of shifted a generation, and my family was living in Washington, D.C. at the time when my great-grandmother who died, so it's a little
different.
But
those seeds are important. I mean, they matter. There's some sort of touchstone there. I mean, you worked on this novel for a long time to get it right.
There's
got to be something in it, like, I have to say this particular thing.
I think my biggest urge was to make a story that explained the life and the death of a woman who was reduced in family stories to Bessie, who died in the baking accident. And that's what people said. And, you know.
So it's a WASP problem.
It's a big problem. The life that she had lived that caused her to kill herself seemed to me important to document and to explore what the ramifications of a suicide are as well.
Also, you had to figure out what it would have been like for a young white girl and a young African American guy to be moving around and going out in Brooklyn. And, you know, what would it be like if they went to a swimming pool? What would it be like if they went to Coney Island? Like, did you have to do research to figure that out? Did you talk to people? How did you figure out, like, what the racial climate was in Brooklyn at this particular time?
The Brooklyn Historical Society Library had a fellowship that I got for making art based on their collections. And I was able to go not just into their amazing collections of books and have help of their archivists and their photo archivists, which I just got pictures of people on the streets in Brooklyn in the period I was writing about. I named a restaurant that comes up because I saw a shot of a street corner that had this little diner called Mammy's Pantry. And I was like, well, that's obviously where they have to go to have pancakes. Little things that you couldn't make up and things that you couldn't find by Googling it, because you don't know you're looking for Mammy's Pantry on the corner of the street in the neighborhood where you live, and it's now a Dunkin' Donuts or something. And I found these scrapbooks in their warehouse that had been acquired from a local neighborhood association from an African-American neighborhood in Brooklyn called Weeksville. And I got memories, photos, clippings, and that was really useful because it sort of welded personal history with the public and the big world historical events that were happening at the time.
Even though you're working from a personal story, it is necessary to like do a lot of research. All that microfiche, seeing pictures like that, it's just irreplaceable. It's incredibly important.
The old microfilms of old newspapers and local papers sometimes are just incredible. You can't figure
by using a search engine.
Exactly.
We have a lot of MFA students in the audience. What happens once you're done with the MFA program and you're like, okay, now what? The structure's gone. I have to continue to be a writer. I have to find a way to do that.
Well, for me, it was kind of odd because I had worked at literary magazines before I went and got an MFA. So it was still hard to decide to keep writing and make a book happen because I didn't have a book when I was finished with my MFA program. Right. It took me a number of years to finish it. But I was in a different position with...
Because you were like a totally hip, you know, ex-Paris Review editor at the time and felt empowered.
Well,
I'm saying these things to irritate you.
I wasn't very hip, and it was really fun to get fired from the board of the Paris Review after having been there for years. So I had my own crises, but I just
I mean, a public space sort of comes out of this rupture that happened at Paris Review, right?
Yeah, a public space was born in a certain way out of a group of editors leaving when the head editor, George Plimpton, died, and there was a wave of change brought in by the board, and it became less of a place for emerging writers. So I work as the editor-at-large of this wonderful magazine, A Public Space, and one of the things we're really devoted to is finding new voices and publishing writers who aren't already represented by agents or don't have book contracts. A first publication for us means a writer who really hasn't been published anywhere, not just a writer who's about to come out with a really well-represented book from Knopf or something like that. We want to be at the ground level. We are offering now twice a year an Emerging Writers Fellowship, and it involves submitting work and having that work edited with a writer and an editor from the magazine and developing not just that story or piece, but also hopefully developing a relationship with the magazine and talking about literature. I'm going to be mentoring somebody in the next round who we're going to be trying to find books to read together. And one of the ideas of a public space is that literature is this place where ideas meet and truth can occur and different voices can express themselves and different truths can emerge depending on the style, the experience, the life history, whatever it is that is coming to inform each writer. So once you finish sitting alone and reading or writing, you engage. conversation should be started by books.
Elizabeth Gaffney, with UMKC's Whitney Terrell as part of the Writers at Work series at the KC Public Library. For links to her novel, When the World Was Young, and the literary magazine, A Public Space, go to newletters.org and search for Back to the Writing Well. We're dipping into that one last time to hear George Saunders. He's famous for his short fiction, winning the 2013 Penn Malamud Award for his body of work, including his short story collection, 10th of December. At a Rainy Day Books event in 2014, he shared stories about how his family helped shape his work.
They influenced me to be a writer just because they were great, funny storytellers, both sides. My mom was from Texas and my dad was from Chicago. And in both families, it was understood that as a kid, if you could keep up your end of the conversation, you could sit with the big people, you know. So in the Chicago side was in the 60s on the South side, and it was always a political fight. And so you were welcome to join in if you had some facts and if you could hold your ground. And my dad was an amazing storyteller. He sold coal on the south side of Chicago. It was during the 60s, so there were riots, and his car was almost tipped over, and he was held at gunpoint against a Coke machine for 2 hours one afternoon. And the thing that I loved about him was when he came home from that day, he was so happy, so excited. He said, "You're not going to believe what happened to me." And he had gotten in there, somebody grabbed him, put him up against the thing, put a gun to his head. My dad said he knew he had to do something because he had us kids, but he was so scared that his hands wouldn't come up. So he just sat there, and he kept, his whole thing was, "I've got to get my hands to come up." And then at the last minute, the landlord, this big woman, came in, grabbed his assailant by the back of the neck and threw him across the room, and my dad made his escape up the stairs. So he comes home from that, and he was so fired up, you know, kind of like, "Oh, what a world. I almost got killed," you know. So I think, you know, Junot Diaz told me once, he said he thought that writers tend to come from families where it's understood that language is power. You know, so for his family, they were immigrants, and he was the first one to speak English, and that was power. And in our house, language was a very, very powerful thing. My dad's stories were always a bit like mine. They were kind of dark, really dark, but with a kind of tender underbelly. He took me to his neighborhood in Gage Park one time, and we drove around for 2 days with a tape recorder. You know, he said, "This is where this happened." And all the stories were so horrible, you know. Like, this is a place where I walked in and my friend's mom and two guys from the Navy, all naked. I'm like, wow. And so this is where I got knifed. This is where, you know. So at the end, I said, "Dad, were there normal people in your neighborhood?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, but they were not so interesting." I took a songwriting seminar with this wonderful songwriter named Mike Smith, who wrote a beautiful song called The Dutchman, if you've ever heard it. But he said that his thing was, he'd write a song, and then he'd listen to Dylan. And he'd say, "Is mine as good as Dylan?" And everybody in the room just groaned, like, "Oh, my God." He said, no. He said, "If you are writing something and you determine that it sucks, you are so lucky, because it means your judgment is still intact. And in the ways that your reading energy deflects negatively, that's where you can do some work." So with my students, I teach at Syracuse, and it's a great program. We got 600 applications waiting at home for 6 spots. So the students are off the charts. And the biggest thing I can teach them is to go back again and again into the work, kind of in a neutral frame of mind, like not rooting for it, not rooting against it, just willing to make little tweaks to change it. Teaching, it makes me so hopeful. I mean, I'm 55, so what happens is, if your brain could be conceived of as a sphincter, at this age, it starts to clench a bit. You know, you Foghat is the only band ever, and, you know. And I think you naturally will say, the kids today with their interweb, you know. But when you're teaching, especially kids who are selected at that rate, you just have your faith constantly renewed. Is literature dying? No way. Is it changing? Yeah. Are there still people in the world who are full of life and love? Yeah, of course, you know. And we get these students right when they are kind of, one, realizing they are writers, and two, having that experience of going, wow, you actually can convert the world into prose, you know. So it's just constantly recharging. You know, given that the world wants you to stop writing, how do you find the courage to keep going? My advice to my female writers at Syracuse is to really cultivate your inner warrior princess, and, you know, don't be a good girl. Be a nasty girl who's getting time no matter what. My wife is a writer, and when we were young and people were coming over and we were both working and the house was a mess, they never looked at me, you know. And seriously, that's really true. You know, partly because of the cultural expectations and so on. I think the trap springs faster for young women. At that time, you know, we had our 2 daughters and we just bought a house and we didn't have a lot of money, but it was a very sweet life. So it's a worthy battle. The resistance was almost like stealing 20 minutes a day of intense private time, and then the rest of the day submitting to responsibilities. And I remember it as a really sweet time, actually, you know.
You're listening to George Saunders as he recounts stories about his writing life in his multi-award-winning book of short stories, 10th of December.
In this book, there's three or four stories where there are multiple points of view. And for me, I think of this as a technique called third-person ventriloquist, where it starts off as your usual third person, and then very quickly, I try to go into the head of the character and assume his or her neuroses and speech patterns and habits and prejudices and the whole thing. Mostly it's a way to exploit voice, you know. I really love doing different voices. So I'm not so comfortable with that sort of standard third person, it was a cloudy day and Fred was feeling pensive. You know, that doesn't really thrill me. But if I can get into Fred's voice, I just find it more enjoyable, really. So that's where it came from. And that, I think, in turn, comes from my understanding of what this reality is, which is that basically, if somebody wanted to be really accurate about what's going on right now in this place, it would probably be 280 thought streams. It would be our brains going with whatever they're doing. You know, there's a certain amount of attention. There's a certain amount of awareness of your physical body. There's a certain amount of thinking about what's happening next. And the weird thing is each human compartment has a different flavor of thought stream. So in my own baby way in those stories, I'm trying to say, okay, I've got three people in the story. Let me assume the voice of each one of them and then show the way that that makes plot, basically. If somebody's standing there thinking, oh, I'm really nervous about my audition tomorrow, and I don't know, I'm kind of nervous about it, I'm kind of an idiot. Everyone has always told me I'm no good as an actor. And then that thought stream goes on and his primary characteristic is nervousness, self-doubt. And then over here there's a guy who's feeling great. I'm kind of just come out of my boxing class. I'm one tough son of a bitch. I hope nobody messes with me, you know. And then the second guy accidentally runs into the first guy. That's plot. So for me, that's really a lot of fun. But it's just the technique for all of my writing, and this is where I get embarrassed because it's so simple, it's stupid, is just to riff. Try to have no ideas about what I'm doing, no themes or no plot, none of that, because that just catches me up. Try to just say, okay, I want to make some language that's kind of fun. Maybe it's funny, maybe it's fast, maybe it's whatever. Get a little bit, just like in biology when you have a seed crystal, just let it sit there and then start poking at it from a linguistic standpoint. Why are you interesting? Why not? Cut this, rearrange. Then as you do that, it does kind of start to produce plot. So I'm just riffing basically. And then the next day I come back and I try to imagine that I haven't read it before and I don't have any attachment to it. And I just have a little meter in my head. This is positive, this is negative. And as I'm reading, I'm just trying to honestly see where the needle is without any, you know, no problem. Just like, little story, how you doing today? And if it says, I suck, you say, all right, well, where do you suck? Page 3. All right, we can do that, you know. And then you just edit again and again. And every time you try to pretend like you're a guy in a bus who hasn't seen it before. And you're just line by line watching that needle and then correcting to taste a little bit. That's really the whole thing, you know. You go through it so many times and it's kind of like remodeling your house for 14 years. By the end of that, it's very you. So that's really the whole technique.
George Saunders. For links to more about his prize-winning book, 10th of December, from that 2014 presentation, or my 2018 interview about his acclaimed novel, Lincoln and the Bardo, visit newletters.org. Want to hear more new shows in the future? Join our Save New Letters on the Air team by emailing radio@newletters.org. Today's show was originally produced with Stephanie Hughes and interns Coy Duggar, Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Paige Lockhart, Tony Van Treese, Abby Jamison, Tim Larrison, and assistant producer Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.